And now our new classic serial. The first episode in a two-part dramatisation of Nicholas Montserrat's searing novel about the men and ships who fought in the North Atlantic during the Second World War. The Cruel Sea.
J'attendrai le jour et la nuit. J'attendrai toujours.
That's it.
Yes.
It's all over. You're just walking out on me.
We're at war. I volunteered for the Navy.
But why does that have to end us?
Because I can't fight a war and love you, Elsie. It wouldn't be fair on the men I'm fighting with. It wouldn't be fair on you.
I'll be the judge of that.
I can't do both.
So all that talk about us living in Paris, sitting in cafes, going to art galleries, you writing a novel...
It's no longer possible. War's been declared.
J'attendrai ton retour.
So, you're both new to the Navy.
Volunteered for it, sir.
Me too, sir.
Lieutenant Lockhart?
Yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Ferriby?
Yes, sir.
We graduated together from the King Alfred Training School, sir, 2 days ago.
How long were you there?
5 weeks.
We'd come up to Glasgow on the overnight train. Had weaved our way through a forest of shipyards, all working at full stretch. Finally found our ship, Compass Rose, being fitted out. Wormed our way between welders, riveters, fitters, electricians, till finally we located the captain's cabin.
Now, what were your jobs before you signed on?
I was a sort of writer, sir.
A sort of writer?
A journalist, sir.
I was a bank clerk, sir.
And why did you choose the Navy?
I used to do weekend sailing on the Solent.
Ferriby?
I've never been to sea, sir. Although once, me and my fiancée did go on a day trip to Calais.
I'm going to expect the highest professional standards from my officers, even if you have only been in the Navy 5 weeks. Our ship, Compass Rose, is essentially a glorified trawler with guns and depth charges stuck on top. At sea in the North Atlantic, she will roll like hell, but I will not permit any loss of discipline or lessening of technical standards among officers or crew. Heavy seas won't kill us. U-boats will. Lockhart, I see you had a gunnery course.
Yes, sir.
You will supervise the installation of the guns and then start training up your crews. Most of them will have been in the Navy an even shorter time than you. Ferriby, you'll take command of depth charges.
Yes.
Now, go find the First Lieutenant. He's somewhere on board. He'll have a whole lot of paperwork for you.
Sir. Yes, sir.
Goodness. He was a bit of a tartar.
Who?
Captain Erickson.
Not necessarily. I looked him up in the Naval Gazette. He's been out of the Navy for 10 years, in the Merchant Marine. He's feeling his way just like the rest of us.
Glasgow town again. Smell that smoke.
You've been posted here before then?
My first ship, Garland, were here.
You were a lifer?
Huh? And you?
Joined up right after that bastard Chamberlain signed his scrap of paper in Munich. Soon as he said, peace in our time, I knew there'd be war on. Nothing else a man of progressive views can do. We'll not get a decent society here in Britain till those Nazi scum
again. Ah, we got a political on board.
Born in Jarrow. Not one man in our street had work. I've got politics in me bones. Hey, what do you think of this corvette we're posted to? Compass Rose.
An overgrown tug with 80 crew rammed in her. Captain and First Lieutenant sound like they know what they're about. You and I are leading seamen. But the other two officers and the rest of the men?
Our prophecy much shouting and use of foul language.
Are you running the depth charges?
Aye.
I'm running our only gun. It's a 4-incher.
That'll sink the Bismarck.
Let's hope our two officers know how to listen.
Red-hot rivets arc through the air. Decks are piled high with toolboxes, oil drums, welding gear. Our ships built around us. Ferriby and I assault an Everest of paperwork in a tiny space which will one day be our wardroom. We share it with an army of painters, decorators, and a carpet layer.
Can you not just move your chair, yeah, sir?
Sorry.
Lock that.
Yeah.
Ferriby?
Sorry. I'm puzzled. I'm filing our navigation charts for each ocean in the world.
Right. Move, sir. Oh,
sorry. The thing is, I've just found one for the River Danube. We're not going up the Danube, are we?
Well, the Royal Navy goes everywhere.
Okay. Look, I'll tell you what, I'll come back later, right?
Sorry.
I'm sure you've always fancied a visit to old Vienna.
Oh, now you mention it, my wife has a real soft spot for that film, Viennese Nights.
Your wife?
Mm.
How long have you been married?
6 weeks.
I see. All this must be quite difficult for you.
No, I feel fine.
At the double! At the double! Down the gangway! Form a line on the forecastle! And stop talking!
Look at him, eh?
Burns. The Burns man.
Stampeding about like a field full of heifers. Two things you need to know about life in the Navy. You keep your mouth shut and your bowels open. And that way you can't never go wrong.
Gradually, as the crew arrive, the decks are cleared of equipment. Grey paint replaces grease. Supplies are loaded. But below deck, there are problems. 50 seamen find themselves forced into a tiny forecastle where all must sleep, eat, and entertain themselves jammed on top of each other. Then our 4-inch gun arrives. A crane starts lowering it in. I'm in charge, with the captain watching.
Take it steady, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
The gun is coming down quite fast. I think it's all right.
The bearings are aligned aft, sir.
Oh?
So perhaps if you gave the order, swivel 180 degrees and steady, sir.
Yes. Right.
Swivel 180 degrees and steady.
There it is. Smack on.
Fine job, Lieutenant. Well done.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Mavis, is that you?
Oh, Gordon.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice. How are you?
Oh, everything's fine here. Everyone sends you their love. How are you?
It's about that I'm phoning.
What is it? Something the matter?
It's just... we're sailing tomorrow.
Yes?
With me up here in Glasgow and you down there in Brixton. I feel so far away.
Oh. Look, tell us what you've been doing on your boat.
It's a ship, actually.
Oh, sorry, your ship.
Well, it's quite difficult. You know that Lieutenant Lockhart that I was on the King Alfred course with?
Yes.
We were talking about how to command as an officer, and he said if he didn't know what to do, he asked the senior rating quietly.
Well, that sounds sensible.
Yeah, but I'm an officer. If I don't know what to do, the men won't respect me. I've got this leading seaman under me, Wainwright. He's quite chippy. And when we're doing our depth charge drills and he sees that I don't know what to do, he openly corrects me in front of the other men. Mavis, I don't feel I'm up to this.
Don't you dare speak like that, Gordon Ferriby. You're a brave man. You volunteered to defend your country, defend your family. You made me feel so proud when I saw you in your uniform. Now, you've got to learn what the right orders are and give them. Then this Wainwright can't say anything. Gordon. Gordon, listen. You and I love each other. However far apart we are. Now, that's the only thing that matters.
A cold, bitter morning. The whole ship's company drawn up on the foredeck for our commissioning ceremony. The captain addresses us.
This is our ship, Compass Rose. On her, we are leaving a world where no man trusts any other man, where men are so greedy that many, many of you here have had no work for years. And we are entering a world where every man must trust, must work for, must look out for every other man, or we shall die. The sea will not forgive us selfishness nor indiscipline. The enemy most certainly will not.
Cast off, foreigners!
Compass Rose slips away from the dock, a ship at last, is towed downriver to a fuel tanker. Then our engines start, gingerly. Shipyard officials in bowler hats and old Macintoshes leap about the ship, listening to engines and main shafts through long stethoscopes. Slowly our revolutions rise, and we slip down the Clyde. City giving way to countryside, then great stark hills of heather and snow. At the tail of the bank, we pass the huge naval anchorage off Greenock.
That battleship there, that's the Royal Sovereign. I saw her on my last trip to Jib. Now that must be the 6th Destroyer Flotilla.
What's that grey hulk over there, Wayne?
Ah, now that. That's the old Argus, one of the first aircraft carriers. And that one down there, that's a new town-class cruiser. I didn't know they commissioned them yet.
Oh, with all this lot about, makes you feel a bit safer.
After we passed Ailsa Craig, we steered north amid the Scottish Isles to where we would conduct our sea trials. And so came our first night, our first watches at sea. And then something every new junior officer dreads.
Fine, clear night, Lieutenant Ferriby.
Yes, Captain.
Calm sea, clear sky. Think I'll turn in.
Turn in, sir?
Yes. Keep her on the same course. If anything turns up, call me on the voice pipe.
And suddenly he stands alone on the bridge, in charge of a ship of 80 sleeping, trusting human souls, his responsibility. He stands, rooted, motionless for several minutes. Finally ventures a question.
Course?
Course north, 10 west, sir.
Stands rooted a bit longer, then ventures to step about the bridge amid the indistinct forms of the lookouts. A whole half hour passes. Then he speaks again.
Seaman Greg, set. How about a cocoa for all of us?
Yes, sir. I'll get down the galley.
Greg returns. Cocoa is handed round. For a while, the lieutenant just sips it. Then...
Where are you from, Greg?
London, sir.
Ah. Like me?
Stepney. I drove a van until all this came along.
And how are you finding the Navy?
Quite difficult. I only just got married, sir.
Huh? Oh, I see.
And they stand close to each other for the rest of the watch.
Breach open!
Breach open!
Clear breach!
Breach clear!
Shell home!
Shell! Ah! What happened, Phillips?
Gunner Stevens appears to have tried to shut the breach on his own hands, sir. Center.
Yes, sir.
He does that while we're in action. And because of you, Sean Orslan's 2 14-inch bricks on our reds, I'll never forgive thee.
At first, our trials among the Hebridean Islands, depth charge runs, fire drills, ASDIC routines, are chaotic. But slowly we start to pull it together. Think as one, not as a crowd. Till finally we can do some things almost efficiently.
Target bearing, red, 4-5. Range, 3,000. Fire!
How's she doing?
Spot on! We hit it!
Gotcha! Yeah.
Good shooting, good crew. Well done.
Our gunnery became competent. We coordinated ASDIC attacks on friendly submarines successfully. And even Ferriby and Wainwright managed to find a way of working so our depth charges flew overboard at almost the right second. We set sail in January, out alone into the sea. where we met our first Canadian-bound convoy, and the Atlantic Ocean. Waves the size of the Albert Hall come at you, hit you like granite cliffs. Everything becomes an act of survival. When you must move, you swing from handhold to handhold like a primitive ape. On the open deck, men scuttle between waves from one shelter to the next. Below decks is even worse, a shambles. In an already overcrowded forecastle, a ball of human flesh rolls and ricochets around. In its midst, men vomit, eat, lie under the table trying to sleep. And one stoic soul sits reading Sex Secrets of the Mysterious Orient. And in the officer's wardroom, sofas murderously break loose, cannon straight at me. I'm handed a pamphlet and informed I am the ship's medical officer. Suddenly, I'm competent to treat serious head concussions, broken limbs, and venereal disease.
Do keep still, Donnelly. Try and serve if the ship keeps moving.
A vast stoker pinned to a table by shipmates. I attempt to splint his shattered arm.
Ah! You all right? How's about you putting down that instruction manual while you're trying to fix me?
A convoy consists of 30 or 40 huge, unwieldy merchant ships of all nationalities, which, so their naval escorts can protect them, bunch closely together in three or four lines and steam forward at the speed of the slowest, trying not to collide. Their escorts, four or five hastily assembled corvettes and destroyers, sail before and after and on each side of them, but because of their superior speed must zigzag back and forth so as not to outrun them. So in a force 11 gale, with lumps of water the size of London buses regularly hitting the bridge, things for the officers in command can get a bit stressful, especially when zigzagging on a pitch black night.
We steered 135 for 5 minutes exactly, turned 90 degrees exactly, and now been sailing the reverse leg for 4 minutes, 30 seconds exactly. We should sight them in 30 seconds exactly.
We might have missed them. Be right in the middle of them. Look out! Have you seen anything? That's a disaster!
We stick to the course we've got. Everyone in a convoy has to rely on everyone else keeping to their pattern.
Gentlemen, how are things?
Oh, very well, Captain. We're on our reverse leg. Should be regaining visual contact with a convoy in 5 seconds.
Good!
Look out! Do you see anything?
Not yet, sir! There, sir! Oh. Merchant vessel, starboard bow!
Coxswain, outward leg again. Steer 135.
And three times up. Can get quite hairy on a night like this.
The captain kept everything going. Amid amateurs, the one professional who saw everything, never let anything get out of hand. The calming presence almost permanently on the bridge.
One good side to all this stormy weather.
Sir?
Keeps the U-boats 100 feet under, unable to attack.
As convoy followed convoy through the spring and summer of 1940, slowly we started to learn. Two groups of men passing in a narrow passage instead of colliding, glide between each other, sweet as Fred and Ginger on a dance floor. In the forecastle, men cut hair, play cards, write letters, while beneath the tables, others sleep like kittens. We continued to practice our ASDIC, gunnery, depth charge techniques, and they improved.
Fire one and two!
One and two, fire, sir!
Which was fortunate, for the war quickly got worse. Norway, then France, fell. The enemy had thousands of miles of coastline from which to deploy their submarines and aircraft. From only a handful in the North Atlantic, suddenly there were hundreds. And across its 3,000 miles, our convoys had to carry our nation's food, materials and weaponry. A frail thread of light in a world of darkness. But still we saw no action.
Come on!
What is it, sir?
Brought the ship to action stations, Lieutenant. Listen.
Deck charges all closed up, Wainwright.
Closed up and ready to fire, sir.
What do you think's happened?
Sounds like an aircraft. One of the long-range Fokker Wolf bombers. Found us somehow in the middle of the night.
The ships underneath it are firing back.
I reckon it's flying down the centre of the convoy.
Oh, let's hope they get it.
It's my first time in action. Feeling a bit nervous.
My first time too, Seaman Wainwright.
Seems to have a particular ship in mind.
Yes.
Yes.
Dear God.
Oh, should we signal Viperous? We'll go and look for survivors?
No, it was the other side of the convoy. They'll get Sorrel to search. Doubt they'll find anything.
And what caused it to just explode like that?
It must have been that ammunition ship.
It just disintegrated. It went straight down.
Well, if you're gonna go, that's the way to go.
Shut up, Donnelly. We don't want to hear your opinions. Get back to your station. Good God.
Dutch merchantman on our port bow, torpedoed.
Asdic, start sweeping to starboard.
Well ahead. Coxswain, steer 80 degrees starboard, start zigzagging.
80 degrees starboard, start zigzagging, stop.
We're lucky, Lieutenant.
Sir?
That torpedo could have only missed us by yards.
Oh.
Signal to Viperous. U-boat attack from south will start search. Lockhart, I'm going to drop a boat to search for survivors. You'll be in command.
Sir?
Pick five men. We'll come back for you when we can.
Yes, sir.
There they are, sir. To starboard. There's quite a few.
Stow the oars. Prepare to take on survivors.
We rescued 14 Dutchmen. One died as we hauled him on board. Two had swallowed fuel oil and would probably die. One had a broken leg. All were in deep shock. The only treatment I could offer before we got on board was rum. And so we turned slowly in the night amid an infinity of stars, hoping to be picked up.
What got you into the Navy, Phillips?
1931, sir. It's when all the banks went bust. Farms was going bankrupt all over Devon. My old man's went under. There was not one job in the whole parish. So it was the Navy for me. It gave me brother half my wages so he could rent some land, but still weren't no profit in it. Not till this war happened along. Best thing has ever happened to farmers.
Finally, after a fruitless search for the submarine, Compass Rose found us and picked us up.
Careful with raising that winch. There's a dead body in the sling.
And it rises up over the rail, naked, stone cold, grey head lolling from side to side.
Oh, God.
Ferriby? You all right?
I've never seen a dead body before.
I know. But get used to it. We're going to see a lot.
Oh.
Are you all right?
Yes.
Three more died during the night. So at dawn, four bodies, sewn in their canvas shrouds, lay in a line on deck. As Compass Rose hurried to rejoin the convoy, the captain spoke the funeral service.
We therefore commit their bodies to the deep, to be turned into corruption, looking for the resurrection of the body. When the sea shall give up her dead, and the life of the world to come, the Lord make his face to shine upon them, and be gracious unto them. The Lord lift up his countenance upon them and give them peace. Amen.
Through the autumn and winter of 1940, our situation gradually deteriorated. Our enemies' tactics, their daring, continually improved. It came so we welcomed the worst, the most destructive weather to sail through because we knew we were safe from them. The worst sinkings were those of oil tankers. All seas around them would burst into great walls of flame and the crew would be trapped on board. What could they do? Stay on board and burn, or jump into the water and be consumed in yet more fire? And on the other side of the flames, in our tiny boat, we would wait to see if any might escape.
Don't bring her in too close, Phillips.
There might be a way opening between the flames, sir.
And there was a small gap where the sea wasn't burning. The tanker crew dived in, started swimming as fast as possible through it.
Come on, man, open the way through!
But then the walls started to close over them, and one by one they were consumed, popping into brief screaming candles of light. One did survive. We dragged him from the water, rowed him home to Compass Rose. Where he and I did wish he had died. Almost all his skin was burnt off. Inside him, his stomach and guts wrenched and writhed and vomited with the burning fuel oil he'd swallowed.
What is that? Why are you blood to let me die? Kill me!
No!
I inject him with the majority of our precious morphine. It makes not the slightest difference.
For Christ's sake, I'm going to die, aren't I?
Yes.
Then bloody kill me.
I can't.
After 7 hours, finally, grudgingly, his body, racked to the end, did die. His blackened corpse lay twisted and at rest upon the table. I recall those letters to our more upmarket papers, such as the Times, from readers almost invariably snug in the home counties, vociferously denouncing the government for their socialistic policy of petrol rationing, demanding their perfect right to drive in their fat, fast cars to whatever racetrack or pheasant shoot they chose to attend. It makes you see red.
Morning, Captain.
What are you doing on the bridge at this hour, Lieutenant?
Come to relieve you on what, sir?
After the night you've had, you're doing no such thing.
Sir?
You're going to your cabin and having 4 hours of sleep, and you'll take a bottle of whiskey with you. You need some beauty sleep.
Sir?
We're on the final leg of this convoy. We'll be in Liverpool in 24 hours. Then we'll all be going on leave.
As we approached Liverpool, the whole crew's spirit rose. Men washed their clothes, cut each other's hair, practiced their dance steps. Except for one rating, Greg, who paced the foredeck deep in thought, reading a letter. And then we were free.
Here she is, Gordon. Ursula. Our first little one.
Yes.
Here. You hold her. Oh. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't she wonderful? Your own child.
Yes.
Now you take her for a walk in the garden and I'll make some tea and bring it out. Gordon, we're a family again.
Go on then, tell us how you see the future.
Oh, the future?
You know, after the war. What's going to change in this country?
I haven't got time to think about that.
What?
Why should anything change?
Everything must change.
Now you're just being political.
You want to go back to the world we had? Bankers ruling everything, mass unemployment.
No.
Look at us, fighting this war. The government's spending millions on it, billions on it. If they can spend billions of pounds on war, they can spend it in peace on a proper health service for our four, education for our bairns, towards building a proper, decent society.
Yeah, they won't ever do that.
They won't have a choice. The British nation won't allow them to do nothing else. Anyway, what are you going to do after the war?
Well, after I leave the Navy.
Aye.
Always fancied running a pub myself. I mean, not a pub like this, 600 drunken sailors in it. A nice quiet cider house. Down some Devon back lane. So there's this handsome young barmaid I know.
Is that the limit of your ambition, man? A pub and a barmaid with large tits.
Right, so what are you going to do?
Running the depth charges is what's going to get
you. Lieutenant Ferriby runs the depth charges.
Aye, that's what he thinks. I got my head around firing sequences, control systems, electronics. I'm doing this radar course while I'm on leave.
You're hungry for a promotion, eh?
I'm hungry for a future, man. The world's changing.
Here we go. Not in this pub, I didn't.
Ursula. Ursula? You're my daughter. Holding you like this in our garden, your tiny, tiny fingers squeezing mine. Just listening to you breathing. It should be the most beautiful. Ursula. I sleep in this tiny dark place, a cabin. Outside there's more darkness, nighttime, an unending ocean beating on us. I rest my head against this steel wall and know just half an inch away is all this wild black water. And at any second through this water, this gigantic steel fish can smash right through the bulkhead and blow me to bloody pieces. I see your lovely body and your sweet mother and all us.
Look, I brought us all out a cup of tea and a cake I baked. Oh, two of you look so sweet. Oh.
Our leave concluded, a ragged assortment of civilians, some even sober, reboard the ship and miraculously transform themselves into sailors once more. Except for one. He who, as we entered port, had paced up and down the foredeck reading a letter. Seaman Gregg. Always reliable. Suddenly he'd disappeared. We sail on our next convoy without him. But when we return, there he is on the dockside awaiting us.
Able Seaman Gregg's been a first-rate seaman up till now. Suddenly he goes AWOL, refuses to give an explanation. He could face serious charges.
Yes, sir?
Lockhart, I want you to find out what's happened.
Isn't that the First Lieutenant's job?
The First Lieutenant's got a medical problem. He's getting treatment.
I'm not sure I'm the right person.
You're a writer, aren't you? Always dealing with characters and their problems. Before I have to sentence him at defaulters, I want to know the background.
Sir.
Steady! Those crates have got plates in them!
Ferriby!
Lockhart!
You've got Gregg in your depth charge crew, haven't you?
That's right.
What's he like?
A good man. Conscientious. Thorough.
I got the impression the two of you are on quite good terms.
I suppose so. Rank permitting. We're both from London, newly married.
Ah.
Is this about his AWOL?
Yes.
Go softly on him. Going home to the family ain't always easy.
Why won't you speak?
Don't want to, sir.
You could get 3 months detention for this. The captain can't do anything for you if you don't offer an explanation. Did you go home?
Yes, sir. I went home. To Stepney.
And?
As I said, sir, no disrespect. I prefer to keep quiet, take my punishment.
All you have to do is explain at defaulters what
explain
happened.
Explain at defaulters, sir. It'd be all over the ship. Private matters.
It wouldn't have to be. You can tell me. I will tell the captain privately. He will take what I have told him into consideration in his judgment. Well?
It won't come out.
No.
Got this letter, sir, from a mate, saying there was something wrong at home. So as soon as we docked, got the train to London, didn't get there till well after midnight. There was this car outside, a flash one, and only one light in the house, the bedroom. Let myself in, then, because I didn't want no misunderstandings, I yelled out I was home. Silence. Not a peep. Then voices. Bit of an argument, then the door to my bedroom opened and over the landing walked this bloke in all flash pyjamas, some travelling salesman. And my missus in a shift. She started yelling at me, telling me I should have told her I was coming home. I told her to shut it. The bloke said, now, we don't want any unpleasantness. I said he'd get unpleasantness if he didn't get out of my house. I'd name him any of the divorce proceedings. That got him shifting. And she yelled a bit more. Then we got to talking.
What? About divorce?
Oh, no, sir. You don't understand. There can't be anything like that.
You're a Catholic?
No. My wife's very young. Easily led. Likes a bit of excitement. Apparently been taking her in his big flash car to race meetings up the West End, you know.
Yes.
The reason there can't be a divorce, sir, is there's a child.
Oh. Is it yours?
Do you have a child, sir?
No, I don't.
Then you can't understand.
Is the child yours, Greg?
That's not the point. The child can't be blamed for what adults get up to. That wouldn't be fair. That kiddie needs love in its life. I love that child.
I see, but I still don't understand why this took you 4 weeks to sort out.
Because that ain't the problem, sir.
Oh.
As soon as I saw the kid, I knew there was something wrong. Thin, wrinkly, got sores on him. Here, I said, you've been looking after Georgie. Of course I have, she fires back. But the first thing next morning, this bossy woman turns up from the council. So she's come to check on the kid because he's been neglected.
So what did you do?
Well, things needed sorting out, sir. I don't know much about such things, but pretty soon I was feeding the kiddie with a bottle, washing his clothes, teaching the missus how to put a nappy on him. My missus ain't bad. She's young, you know. It was one of those marriages what takes place in a rush because you volunteer to go to sea in 3 days and you love each other.
Yes. I understand.
She's a good kid. And all the time I was working on the local council, showing them Georgie was being cared for, putting on weight and smiling. Got my sister drop in once a day. Though she's got her hands full with 5 kids in the bombs. Just to check things was okay.
So, you think you got it worked out?
Yes, sir. I do.
I looked at him. He seemed confident. But the distance between a ship in the middle of the Atlantic and one small house in Stepney is almost infinite. Walking back to report my findings, I cold-bloodedly congratulated myself on severing all my links with land.
Come.
The captain, only 3 hours before sailing to join another convoy, sat buried beneath a mountain of paper.
You know, Lockhart, someone once said, war is 5% tedium, 1% extreme violence and terror, and 94% paperwork. Pass me one of those F-54s.
I explained to him the problems of Seaman Greg, tried to make a case for him, but he scarcely listened. An hour before we sailed, defaulters was held.
Center attention! Caps off!
Erickson stared at Greg, stern as Zeus upon Olympus.
Able Seaman Greg.
Sir.
To desert your post when your ship could be involved in action is a most heinous crime
and deserves the heaviest punishment.
Well, I'd tried. With iron discipline, the captain had brought us safely through 2 years of terror and danger, even turned us into a halfway decent ship. Start to show mercy, and what signal would that send the crew? The poor kid in Stepney would become one more minor statistic in the waste and barbarism we daily wade through.
This is a crime which, as I said, normally attracts the heaviest, gravest penalties. But in this case, I believe that mercy should be shown. I've therefore decided not to sentence you to detention.
My God. He's shown mercy. Greg showed his son, his wife, mercy. And now...
Stand over.
Caps on. Right turn. Pit march.
And Lieutenant Lockhart, if you'd stay behind.
Oh, yes, sir.
This may come as a bit of a surprise.
Sir?
The first lieutenant's gone down with acute appendicitis. Peritonitis has set in. It's far too late to get a replacement.
Oh.
I'm appointing you acting first lieutenant.
What? But, sir...
You know the job, Lockhart.
What, just?
You don't take things for granted. You can think on your feet. And you know when to be a bastard.
A first lieutenant is responsible for everything that happens on board ship. Supplies, ammunition, armaments, the morale and well-being of the crew. So when the captain takes command on the bridge, everything functions efficiently. At sea, we were losing the Battle of the Atlantic. U-boats had perfected their wolfpack tactics. By 1942, they had 100 U-boats continuously at sea. Packs of 20, 25 were decimating convoys. My job became a series of nightmare improvisations, pretending the Emperor wore clothing and being dug out of holds by the patience of my shipmates. Somehow, we survived. All in time for the most terrible convoy of the war. Convoy OG-83 consisted of 21 deep-laden merchant ships bound from Liverpool to Gibraltar. It had five escorts, Viperus in the van, Compass Rose to starboard, our sister ship Sorrel to port, two in the rear. From the start, the weather mocked us. It was perfect. The sun shone down on a sea unruffled as a dance room floor. Men wore singlets, sandals, off-duty stokers lay out naked, sunning themselves on the afterdeck like half-roasted bullocks. One of the merchant ships carried a draft of 20 wrens. They lined the deck and waved cheerfully back as we sallied past, their hair tumbling in the breeze. It didn't last.
What's that, sir?
What's it sound like, Ferriby? A reconnaissance aircraft, a Fokker Wolf, which will doubtless spend the next few hours circling us just out of range and radio our exact location to every U-boat within 200 miles. We have been located.
We were to spend the next 8 days almost continuously at action stations.
Merchant ship torpedo to starboard!
Which one?
Norwegian freighter, sir!
God, the one with those poor girls on.
Sorrel's turning to give aid, sir!
It's sinking tonight. This convoy is going to be bloody.
One of the girls had been pulled alive out of the sea by another merchantman. As we passed her later in the day, she sat alone, huddled on the deck, staring out to sea. No brave waving. There was no let-up. As more and more U-boats were vectored in on us and our losses increased, we started to harvest from the seas a polyglot of races, some in tattered rags, others naked, lying wounded or asleep in our passageways, cluttering the deck and forecastle as our crew pushed through them to attend to their duties. Corned beef sandwiches and cocoa became the universal fare. Hindus survived on bread and powdered eggs. A naked African hid beneath a blanket. But not a word of dissension or anger. All the different races unified by one overriding fear. The sea.
News from the Admiralty, number one.
Sir.
As soon as night falls, the whole convoy will steer due east.
Almost at right angles.
Put on all possible speed. We might escape.
It worked. For two whole days and nights, we sailed free and fast. Men started to relax, sleep a bit. believed the worst was over. The gods were toying with us.
Oh, the fucker wolf's back.
Looks like they found us again. Round two.
Them bastards. Well, they found us again.
Of course they have, man. The Nazis. What's the only thing they're good at? That's why we have to fight.
The damn planes, they make you feel so naked.
The captain immediately sensed the mood. He passed among us, chatted, joked, shook hands with the ghostly survivors. Double rations of cigarettes were handed out. I saw what a captain was. All the time, like an actor, he has to play a role. When men are overconfident, he tames them. When underconfident, he cheers them. Always he is something he isn't. On the sixth day, under the merciless sun, two ships were torpedoed. Then, just as dark was falling.
Ship torpedo to port!
Who is it?
That's Sorrel's position, isn't it?
Yes, sir, it's Sorrel!
Christ!
What can you see, Greg?
Going down fast, sir!
Why, Sorrel, she's our sister ship!
Shut up, Ferriby. Send immediate signal to Viperus. Permission to pick up Sorrel's crew.
Sir!
Doubt there'll be many survivors if we get to her.
Quite correctly, Viperus refused us permission to immediately pick them up. It was far more important we protect our few surviving merchant ships. Next morning, we found Sorrel's few survivors alone in the open sea. A miserable clutch of men clinging to two life rafts. Around them float a fringe of corpses frozen to death overnight in the cruel cold sea. On one raft, the captain, in his arms a young, dead seaman, head thrown back, mouth hanging open. As we stared down on them, and the living and the dead stared back up at us, we realized we were Sorrel.
Hurry up, you men! Get those bodies winched
in! Come on, mate! Over the rail! I know this one.
We've got his legs.
Fouled me in that football match we held last year. He had a vicious tackle, these legs.
Him over there with the ginger hair. I had a long chinwag with him afterwards in the pub. About how after the war we were going to build a new education system. Christ, he had two pens. And Mrs. They were watching the match.
Lieutenant Ferriby, you finished down there?
Yes, sir!
We're getting underway! Lockhart.
Sir.
Signal from Viperus. Return at once to convoy.
Something up?
Signal traffic indicates more U-boats on the way. Two further ships lost.
That only leaves seven.
Yeah, and still 2 days to go. When did you last sleep, number one?
I don't remember. 3 or 4 days ago. You, sir?
Can't remember either.
Dear Mavis, I'm writing you this letter because I can't write, I can't say it to anyone else. I'm scared. Terribly scared. Out of 21 ships we set off with, 14 have been torpedoed. It is explosions, drownings, sufferings. Let me tell you. This tanker sank last night. There were flames everywhere, but about 20 alive in the water, and the captain decided to... Why on earth he did it, I don't know. Decided to rescue them. You see, on board, we have all these survivors from other ships already. The sea we're in is full of submarines. The Admiralty say there are at least a dozen around us, and when you go in against this sheet of flames and stop to pick up survivors, you can be seen from miles around by any submarine. And every second you can be struck by a torpedo. And I'm saying, I'm screaming to myself over and over. Get out of here. There are only 20 in the water. There are 200 lives in this ship. And you're risking all of us. But no. All the crew is terribly calm. Slowly going through all the actions of pulling them from the sea, checking there aren't any more, and I'm having to be calm as well while...
Oh, Ferby.
What is it?
Nothing, I just thought you'd be asleep.
No, I'm just writing a letter to Mavis.
You all right?
Of course I'm all right.
It's just... I've been noticing recently.
Oh, God, what's that?
Sounds like another one.
Once again, as though in a dream, we go to action stations. The captain arrived on the bridge just before me, and I saw him suddenly snap from a grey, shambling shadow to a lean, alert figure of authority.
Start as Dick sweeps. Gun and depth charge crews ready.
When all else is gone, you still have discipline. It alone keeps you going.
She's sinking slowly. No lifeboats down, though.
Looks like they got jammed in the stays, sir.
That submarine must be very close. Stand by the Asdic hut, Lockhart. I want immediate reports.
Sir. Ship's crew's jumping straight into the water, sir.
Steer toward them.
Sir.
We'll pick them up.
Sir, there's something on the Asdic.
What?
We think it's a submarine, sir. Yes, sir, I'd say she's dead ahead. Just where those men are in the water, sir.
Let me see. You sure? It could just be the hull of the sinking ship reflecting.
No, sir. I'd say that was the exact profile of a submarine.
I'd agree, sir. There you are, sir, dead ahead.
Yes. Right.
And in a second, he changes again. From captain to outcast. The pariah who would butcher the innocent.
Full speed ahead! Coordinate run with Asdic bearings. Do as I order, coxswain, or you'll be on a charge.
Lockhart, order depth charge release when on target.
Yes, sir.
And don't take that tone of voice with me, First Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
We surge forward, straight toward the swimming, struggling survivors.
Three degrees starboard, depth 110. 3 degrees starboard, depth 110.
All watch, horror-struck. Our refugees line the side, stand transfixed. Our gunners stare down. Suddenly, the swimmers realize we're not their saviors, we're their executioners. They throw their arms up, scream, try desperately to swim out of our way as we sweep into their midst.
Fire depth charges! Fire depth charges!
We all turn, face astern. A dreadful calm. Terrible explosions, men are pulped out of all shape, others gutted from chin to crutch, neat as any herring. One poor soul is blown high into the air, arms and legs windmilling crazily.
What do you have on the sonar? Where's the submarine?
Can't get anything, Captain.
What do you mean? Can't get anything?
Nothing on the screen, sir. It's blank.
There's nothing there, sir.
And there was nothing there. Finally, our now minuscule convoy, leaving to its rear a great catastrophic wake of human carnage and flotsam, hobbled into jib. That evening, I went to see my captain in his cabin. In Genesis, Ham steps unexpectedly into his father's tent, sees Noah lying naked, drunk, helpless on the floor. I see my captain, naked, drunk, helpless on the floor.
Poor old bastard. Come on. Let me help you into your bunk. Come on, sir.
Which I did. Then I went to my bunk, and with two bottles of cheap Algerian wine purchased on the quayside, I drank myself into oblivion. But the Navy is no respecter of sensibilities. 2 days later, we were at sea, on the reverse convoy back to Liverpool, working back through the same murderous waters we just traversed.
What's happened, Greg?
Don't know, sir. The engines seem to have stopped.
Oh, Lord. Captain, what is it?
There's a blockage in the fuel pipe. Chief tells me it'll take at least 12 hours to fix. The convoy will go on without us.
And we'll be stuck here, in these waters.
Yes, Lieutenant. In these waters, with a full moon.
In part one of The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Montserrat, Lockhart was played by Gwilym Lee and Captain Erickson by Jonathan Coy. Ferebee was Carl Prekop, Wainwright, David Seddon, Phillips, Peter Hamilton Dyer, Greg, Harry Livingston, Mavis, Tracy Wiles, the coxswain, James Lely, and Donnelly was Adam Billington. The Cruel Sea was dramatized by John Fletcher, and the director was Mark Beebe.
And you can hear the second part of The Cruel Sea at the same time next week.
On BBC One.
There was a time when Britannia really did rule the waves.
Jeremy Paxman traces the rise and fall of the British Empire, a story of exploration and grand ambition.
Once, the Navy forced Britain's will onto foreign governments. That heritage helped Britain to believe she's still entitled to a place at the top table in world affairs. How did such a small country get such a big head?
Empire begins tomorrow night at 9 on BBC One and BBC One HD.